Welcome to Module 1, School Professionals and Vision.
Hi, I'm Robert Constantine from Vision Rehab OT. We're going to tell you the team members involved in Vision in a school-based context and give you some guidance about who might be the best, the most efficient doctor to see your patients. And we're going to ease right into it. So away we go.
Before we get started, we want to make very clear one thing. We're going to be talking about which eye care professionals are best to refer your students to. However, access is the most important thing. Some of your students may not have access to the eye care professional that we would opt to recommend, but as long as they get to an eye care professional, that's what is important. Some children may not have insurance. They may have to pay out of pocket and they may not be able to afford that. It's also a matter of who's available in the community. Some students live in rural areas and they may not have access. So recommending expensive, inaccessible eye exams could actually mean that the student doesn't get an eye exam. We just want to make that really clear before we get started.
The eye exam that happens is the best eye exam. And so what's vitally important is we know that we are working with children that are in best corrected visual acuity, that they have had a comprehensive eye exam from an eye doctor. One of our lessons today is going to be that pediatricians don't do eye exams. Pediatricians do vision screenings. The screening device that they utilize is going to miss 30% of farsighted kids. This means 30% of the kids who can't see up close are being told they don't need glasses when they look at that screener. Those are the kids who I'm seeing in my outpatient, but you're seeing these children as well as part of your school-based practice.
There are definitely barriers to consider when it comes to proper vision care. Many parents are unaware that they should have taken their student for an eye exam. They may be thinking that the quick screening that the child gets at school or at the doctor's office may be sufficient, but it really isn't. So parent awareness is an issue. There's also the issue of getting pushback from administrators. Many school practitioners have expressed to me that they feel really hesitant to bring up this aspect of care because the school district may have to pay for it, or they're looking for the exact proper words of what to say. They may hear, don't say that in the CSE meeting, because then the school district will end up having to pay for it. There's also another aspect where certain optometrists may feel that OTs aren't sufficient to work on visual issues. And we discussed that in a previous module about how vision is within our OT scope of practice. So if you need to go back and refresh, we do have certain aspects of visual care in our scope of practice, but that is, some optometrists have that opinion that we shouldn't be doing it. So that's another barrier. There's always the concern over payment for parents who don't have the proper insurance or whose insurance doesn't cover the eye care professionals. But there's also those ethical considerations, and this could be a whole nother course in itself. In fact, it will be very soon. But there are ethical considerations of us not speaking up if we see that a student has something going on visually, but we're hesitant to bring it up because of pushback from administrators. So there are a lot of challenges and a lot of barriers when it comes to proper vision care. We're here to help you address some of those challenges and get through some of the weeds in who you should refer to, when to refer, and what to say when you're looking to refer. So here are some of the school professionals that look at vision. We have the school physician, the school nurse, the school OTPs, the teacher of the visually impaired, and then the certified orientation and mobility specialist. So this is interesting. Federally, there is no mandate that every single school district needs to have a school physician, but certain states, state by state, do have laws that require the schools to have a physician on staff. This is generally a physician who's on staff as a consultant. They may come in for certain things. It may be more prevalent in one district over another, depending on the district's socioeconomic status. I know that my school district has a school physician, but I've never, ever seen that person in my 23 years of working in a school. But I have heard of employees needing to go see that school physician if they have been out for a really long time and the school wants to basically make sure that they really are sick. So we hear that there's a school physician on staff, but we definitely should not be expecting or relying on that person to have an active role in our students' vision. The school nurse is definitely probably the first line of...
Yeah, that's going to be the first line of defense looking at the screening. So I've done some research on the screenings, and The protocols done by the nurses vary greatly from district to district. Some of the school districts are actually using the same screening device that the pediatricians are using. The other problem that happens is the screening protocol may just be looking at how efficient is distance vision. And we know in the 21st century classroom, there's a whole lot more learning that's happening here in those first 18 inches than what's happening looking at the board. So we certainly have to be aware of what the protocol, what is the school nurse actually assessing? Are they assessing near vision at all? It would be unusual for a school nurse to be looking at ocular motor skills and near vision focusing. In best case scenario, there is the screener that, by the way, is still going to be missing 30% of children who can't see up close.
So then we have our school occupational therapy practitioners, and we're probably the only staff members who are actively looking at and working with our students' vision. I know many school occupational therapy practitioners don't really feel competent in this area. That's why we're here. That's why we're here to support you, and that's why you're taking this course. And we're so glad that you're here. We're going to talk a lot more about what we can and can't do. The next person that I want to speak about is the teacher of visually impaired. And then we have our certified orientation and mobility specialist. I have to admit, in my 23 years, I have never referred out for a TVI or a COMS. I think that has to do a lot with the population that I serve. I'm working with mostly general education students, some special education students, but I'm not involved in the very high medically complex students. So if you are working with those kinds of students, then you probably will need to know this information, which is why we're really passionate about providing it for you. So I just want to talk about this quote because I think it's really important. And I actually found this kind of information in many of my resources regarding vision, but this one quote I pulled out, and it's by Mitchell Scheinman, who is an optometrist. He's married to an OT, so he really gets it. And in his article, in his book, he wrote, "The school vision screening has very little value and should not be relied on as an indication of whether a vision problem is present." So, although I put these five people up, these five school professionals that are somehow in the scope of vision, it's really us. And that's why we want you to be aware and feel confident in what you need to do and what you can do. School occupational therapists, our scope of practice, we are basically looking at how does vision impact the daily functioning and the participation for our kiddo? How does this impact what they can do in school? Now, our key responsibilities when it comes to vision are to do a functional vision assessment, to do environmental modifications for our kids based on their visual needs or preferences and how they learn. We can be involved in their assistive technology training. This is another gray area. In many states, OTs can be assistive technologists without some kind of special certification or without having to take a special test. I know that that's the case in New York. If you are an OTP who's interested in learning assistive technology, research your guidelines in your state, and then you can just start taking courses and figure it out and start learning more ways to help your kids because assistive technology is a key factor for students with vision issues. We're also looking at how this ties into their fine motor skills, their activities of daily living, their sensory processing, and their transition planning. We're looking really at the environment and do we need to change up their workspace? Do we need to modify their positioning? There are so many things that we're already innately doing, and now we're just looking at how are we applying this to their vision.
So, teachers of the visually impaired have attended some of my classes around, and what happens sometimes is they are being referred. For instance, if a child is diagnosed with convergence insufficiency from an optometrist. In some systems, a visual perceptual deficit is termed as a visual impairment, and teachers of the visually impaired are being referred in to help with these kids. What those teachers will tell you is they have no training and no background in anything concerning visual perception. They don't do ocular motor tasks. They're not familiar with near vision focusing. They are first teachers that have a master's level education that makes them teachers of the visually impaired. They're going to be working with students that are having issues of acuity, whether this is low vision or blindness or near blindness. They're going to be talking about very specific assessments they do for low vision, perhaps braille instruction, academic accommodations. They are going to be looking at modifications to the curriculum and the use of technology, training in the use of that technology as well, and the social skills and career education. So these teachers, their background is teaching first. Those things, and it does happen because they've been in my class and told me, like, they sent me this kiddo with convergence insufficiency, and I don't even know what that is. And I certainly don't know how to manage it. Those sort of things are happening with our TVIs. With TVIs, to qualify, at least here in the state of Florida, for a teacher of the visually impaired, the child has to have an acuity below a certain level. They have to be considered, quote, legally blind, and that makes them eligible for services from the teacher of the visually impaired. Again, that varies from state to state, but be aware that their specialty doesn't have anything to do with oculomotor tasks. It's all about acuity, adaptations, modifications, and instruction for a child with low vision or reduced visual acuity. Orientation and mobility specialists are also part of vision teams that are involved in low vision. They as well, as this is a master's level course as well. I'm not sure what their undergraduate degrees tend to be in, but this is also a master's level class that is going to be involved in teaching those orientation and mobility skills. They're going to be teaching things like how to use public transportation and route planning. They're going to be teaching instructions on the use of a white cane, perhaps of a guide dog. So the O&M specialists are going to be about getting from here to there and doing that safely with reduced or low vision. I have not had an O&M attend one of my classes, by the way, but these folks are interested in teaching an individual with low vision, with blindness, how to navigate safely through their environment, whether their environment is going through a department store, utilizing public transportation, or getting around their school.
So, according to Mitchell Scheinman, there's a four-step interrelationship model. Our first job is to rule out any vision issues with our students. And this is often another thing, another barrier, because we're given a student, we're told to go do an occupational therapy evaluation on this student, and we have a timeline, right? So we need to get it done within a set amount of time that goes with what the law is for special education, as well as our schedule and our crazy workload. We got to get this done. But we don't know if this student had a vision exam. We don't know if they've got vision issues. So it kind of becomes a gray area where we want to find out. We definitely should ask the teacher. We can ask the parent. I usually send an email out just to touch base with the parent. What are your main concerns? This way I can put it into my report. I send home an eye exam reminder sheet to all of my students in the beginning of the year, but often the kids that are being referred to me are not on my caseload. So they may not have gotten this eye exam sheet, or the parents may have just, said, "Oh, this looks nice," and not actually done anything about it. So we do have that resource for you in your handouts. It's just a good way to kind of be on top of things. If we recommend that the parent takes the child to the doctor and it comes back that their visual function is normal, then we can proceed to do our OT evaluation. Sometimes we have to proceed anyway because of the timeline. So that's just being realistic. But it might come back that there are vision deficits that need to be addressed. And in this is the case, we really want to try to establish some kind of a relationship with that optometrist so that we can follow up on their recommendations. There are certain things that OTs can do without an optometrist guiding them, but there are other things that they really should be consulting with and kind of checking in and establishing that relationship. After that happens, we have a consultation with that professional, then you want to have ongoing consultations. So whether that's emails, just checking in, how's the student doing? Is there anything else I should be working on? Here's what I'm seeing. What else do you suggest? Just to have that collaboration to really support our kids.
Absolutely. So this collaborative model, optometry, is a very much developing model over the last 4 or 5 years, with Salus University having a doctorate level program that trains OTs in vision remediation and the things we're talking about. How that collaboration model looks is still being defined, but if we're going to be working with vision, we need to have a decent relationship with an optometrist. So the other thing to be aware of when we talk about, so we were at step four, now we're going to go back to step one because that's how it works. So when we're giving things like visual perceptual testing, when we're doing things like visual motor integration testing, all of these tests assume and require that the child is in best corrected visual acuity in order for the results to be valid. With visual motor integration, we kind of have to fudge with that a little bit, but know that acuity and binocular vision problems definitely play a role in the results of visual perception testing in a negative way, where we are going to find we're going to have kids who are not doing well on visual perception testing, not because they can't process the visual information, but because they're not getting accurate visual information in. If there's any way possible to explain at an IEP meeting to a parent who's asking about why isn't my child progressing, suggesting, particularly when this child hasn't had an eye exam, that, well, we're not sure if he can see, and we're doing things in school that are very vision reliant and require best corrected vision, and we're not sure if he can see or not because he hasn't had an eye exam. Keeping those things in mind as we're doing those assessments, and you guys are under time limit. Like, we have so much time in order to get these things done. So you're going to have to
I would
do this
change that to
testing.
say so little time to get things done.
Yeah, so it is. So you're going to have to do that testing. Just be aware that the result of that testing, particularly when we're plainly seeing children rubbing their eyes and blinking excessively and turning their head and doing these other things we're going to be talking about, when they're clearly struggling with near vision, that certainly needs to be a part of your discussion of the results when we're talking about a visual motor integration test or a visual perceptual test.
And that's a good time to recommend, not even, oh, we're not sure if they can see, because that's sometimes the parents will say, oh, I took him to the doctor. They said he's fine. But did they take him to the right kind of doctor? And they may not have access to the kind of doctor that we'd like them to see, but maybe they do. So it's worth kind of going into who's who in terms of vision. And we're going to talk about that now.
So when do we need to refer to a TVI? A lot of times for a teacher of the visually impaired, you're going to see this as a diagnosis. They're going to have cortical visual impairment. It may be retinitis prematurity. There may be retinitis pigmentosa. So there's going to be a vision-related diagnosis most likely mentioned in this child's history in their record. We start seeing visual concerns, OT interventions not progressing, parents mentioning, suggesting low vision, neurological events early at birth, a lot of times are an indication of some potential cortical visual impairment. When we are seeing things where they're avoiding, or it seems like they're completely misreading print-based activities, or they're using a lot of excessive assistive technology.
We also want to make sure that before we recommend any kind of very expensive assistive technology, we rely on our TVIs. The teacher of the visually impaired can be an amazing asset for an occupational therapist in the school setting. So if you don't have one that's on staff, definitely speak to your administrators about the role of a TVI and how certain interventions may be outside of our scope of practice. And basically kind of admitting, this really isn't within my scope of practice. I need some help to make sure that I'm doing justice to this student.
Yeah, we get when we start to learn about vision, we want to become all things to all people. And we are not. So we definitely need that team. As I'm working with concussion patients, this becomes a thing. So what about OEMs, therapists? When we are having trouble with kiddos finding their way around school, and we're aware that there's a potential reduction in visual acuity, there's been a fall or an injury, but mostly we want to prevent that fall or injury from happening. But when families are talking about their ability to navigate, they're having a hard time finding the cafeteria, these sort of things, they're having some apprehension about moving independently through new spaces. These are very busy environments for our kids as well as they're walking around. So knowing how to utilize their vision to get through there. So difficulty with navigation, anytime they're talking about a white cane, a guide dog, your O&Ms are going to be very helpful in fulfilling that instruction beyond a PT who's going to be working on the quality of the gait and the posture and those sort of things.
So on that note, when I'm learning about and hearing about COMs, I'm thinking, so when would I call in the COM versus the PT? And I think this slide really kind of sums it up. The PT is looking at the actual motor skills, the balance reactions during fall and stumbles, gross motor delays. PT would work with a child who gets too tired to actually navigate the community, if they have unsafe movement patterns and the family's worried about their endurance. This would be more of a PT issue, but it does kind of seem like they overlap. And I think that that's the case in many of our school professionals when we look at them. We all kind of overlap in many ways. And rather than looking at that as we're breaching each other's scope of practice, it's much more productive and solution focused to say, okay, how can we collaborate? I'll look at it with my lens, you look at it with your lens, and how can we come up with the best solution for this child?
Yes, the power of interdisciplinary teams. We are well aware that things go better when we're all having a look and giving our input.
Mm-hmm.
So when we start thinking about that OT practitioner working closely with the TBI, the OT may have certain modifications in place already. When it comes time for more elaborate assistive technology, things like close CCTV training, which is a camera and puts text up on a big screen, perhaps the use of magnifiers and these sort of things to help with academics. They do have a specific low vision visual skills assessment that's specific for an academic environment. Transition planning is big. I had a child with optic nerve hypoplasia that at 3, we transitioned him to the TBI in an effort to get skills ready for him to start kindergarten. So having those sort of transition plans and thinking ahead with that, modifications for the tasks, things like high contrast, larger fonts, higher contrast screen colors, those things work. And again, workspace setups, things like text-to-speech are helpful, and independent skills as we're figuring out other things like lunch and libraries and that. The O&M folks are going to be about safety, about preventing those problems as a person with low vision or reduced vision is navigating their academic environment. We may be looking at sensory strategies, perhaps the need for glasses, perhaps the need for specific tints in glasses that may actually highlight the environment and make things easier to navigate. Talking about physical positioning, balance and coordination, any adaptive equipment that's needed as they're moving around as well. Even figuring out how to, for instance, utilize an elevator as a person with reduced vision, as well as public transportation and any sort of motor planning things involving the use of those tools. So when we work together, we get better things happening. You know, we solve problems better, we get a bigger look, and that's what we're hoping for, is the best possible solutions and outcomes for our kids.
So here are some of the things that OTs, PTs, and COMs may be consulting on and overlapping on: travel technology app, social skills training. The TVI and the COMS both could address this, but it seems also to me like so could the OT, so could the PT. So this is why it's important to kind of not only reach out to the other professionals, but to work with them. You don't want to be an island. You've got to work with other people. Find out what's really happening if you can. I know that sometimes time is an issue or a barrier, but it's so important. We are teaching the students self-advocacy, problem solving, navigating the community, and then PT and community orientation mobility specialists may be working together on endurance, balance, access to the community, maybe adapting sports, and then definitely emergency procedures. That's really important in the schools. So going through all these, you may have no experience with these professionals, or you may be very experienced with these professionals. You may be thinking, my administrator would push back. That's one of the barriers that we were speaking about in the beginning of the course. However, what we did for you is in your resource pages, we gave you some documentation examples. If you're feeling like, I need to advocate for this student to reach out for a TVI, I think my administrator is going to push back. We gave you some resources on what to say, exactly how to document what you tried and what your need is and why you need this other professional. So I think that may be really helpful when it comes to moving forward with collaborating with other staff if you're feeling that pushback. So the important thing is that you know your lane, but you don't want to build walls. We need to be working with each other to make the utmost optimal learning environment for our kids. When in doubt, pick up the phone, reach out, document your thinking, because time flies. And, you know, if we're not writing the dates or what happened or why we problem solved something out, why we reached out, why we didn't reach out, that can end up being a legality issue and it can come back on us. So document your thinking every single time. You don't have to be the vision expert. If something feels out of your realm, then reach out and ask for help. That is absolutely okay. That is professional. That's being a professional. That's being competent. Collaboration beats isolation every single time, no matter what. And you'll also be learning so much more from these other professionals who have a different lens, and they'll be learning from you. When in doubt, trust your gut, and then get backup from your school colleagues. This child's safety and participation in school and learning is number one. It's better to refer a child early than to struggle all alone. So let's talk about some of the professionals that we may be referring to.
All right, so let's talk about our docs and who are these folks? What are they good at? Who's going to be best suited to see our kid? So first we have ophthalmologists. An ophthalmologist is a medical doctor that specializes in the health of the eye. So they can refract. That's the better worst game the doctor does in order to figure out what your glasses prescription is. So an ophthalmologist will refract and prescribe glasses. They may or may not support active vision intervention. What I found over the years is that a lot of times for an ophthalmologist, if their acuity is corrected to 20/20 and their eyes are healthy, then their visual system is fine and there isn't any problems, functional problems related to their visual system. This is changing a bit with time, even since we did the first version of this course. Research has shown that there is more than being 20/20 in healthy eyes. And we're slowly finding ophthalmologists coming around to that. Even the local one here has been a lot more open to the vision intervention that I provide here. So the good thing about an ophthalmologist is there's lots of ophthalmologists. They typically take medical insurance or vision insurance, depending on which one the patient has and which one the student has. And also depending on exactly what's happening. In a regular eye exam, that's typically covered by vision insurance. If there's a medical diagnosis, that would be if we find something like an amblyopia or perhaps they've had a cortical visual impairment, something like that, that may go as a medical insurance claim instead. There are pediatric ophthalmologists. There may not be a lot of them in your area. There's only one here in my little town of Pensacola, Florida. There are also neuro ophthalmologists as well that are going to be involved specifically in dealing with problems of vision starting at the optic chiasm going back. So these may be the doctors that are involved in looking at visual field cuts. They may be looking at cortical visual impairment and these other sort of more cortically based visual problems as opposed to problems with the eye doctor. So they may be looking much more specifically at neurological problems related. So our optometrists, there's a whole bunch of optometrists, right? And so an optometrist is not a medical doctor. They go to optometry school and there's a very broad range of optometrists. If you pull into your optometrist's parking lot and it says on the front, there's a big flyer, it says, free eye exam with purchase of glasses and the glasses are ready for an hour in an hour and you get the second pair for 50% off. They're not in the eye exam business. They're in the business of selling glasses and contacts, and that's okay. That's not a bad business to be in. We need to do that. But know that doctor may be a little more interested and actually a little more required to see as many patients as they can in a day. And so some of our friends with special needs that require a little extra patience, a little extra time, might not be best served there. They are typically covered by insurance. Vision insurance typically pays for an optometry visit. There are a whole bunch of them, right? If we're looking around for an optometrist and we want to find out if they're the right OD to see our kids, we might want to start with a doctor-owned practice. Doctor-owned practices, that doctor gets to set their own protocols. They get to decide how long they spend with a patient, and they're not under a big corporation that's requiring them to see so many patients a day. So we're going to be looking for those doctor-owned practices. You may find, after sending patients to a couple of different of these doctor-owned practices, that you know what, there's this one doctor that's really, really good and really does a nice job with our kids. What's great in, and we know this in our special needs community, is when there's someone who's really good at something, the word gets out, right? And the parents yeah. tell each other. And all of a sudden, this my doctor here in Pensacola, who left us a couple years ago, he moved. He didn't leave us. He moved. So the parents here loved him. He did a fantastic job explaining things. And when he moved, the whole special needs community was like, where'd Doc go? Where's he going? Like, we need an eye exam. It's like, well, he's left. And I have three or four eye doctors that I've been working with here that are doing a great job with our kids, with our kids that need that. So there are eye doctors that are pediatric specialists. They tend to be fewer and far between, but they are out there. You're more likely to find a doctor that has that just has a preference, that's comfortable seeing first kids in general, and secondly, to see special needs kids. It would be difficult for any optometrist right now who's seeing any number of children to not be aware of very basic accommodations for a child with autism, for instance. There's just too many kids with autism. So, but you will find those that are better than others.
So one tip I want to give right now that was a big help for me was when I did find out which doctors were the ones to recommend and which ones were looking at the way the student's visual system was impacting their learning and willing to do vision therapy with them. In my area from my school district, I found about three or four, and I made just a quick one-page handout for parents, and I wrote optometrists in Nassau County. And I just left it at that. I put their names, their phone numbers, their addresses, and then I included it with the eye exam reminder handout, which gives the specifications of what kind of eye exam we're exactly looking for. This was an awesome resource that I made that I have used over and over again for my community. It's a really easy thing to do for your own community once you figure out who those people are. And what's the website, Robert? COVD?
The website is covd.org to find vision therapy doctors, but we're going to talk about that when we get to the vision therapy doctor slide next.
Will a local optometrist who does vision therapy be on the COVD website?
Yes, they will be
Okay.
on there.
Okay, so
Yes.
that's just one thing you can do as a school OT to really show yourself as a resource is to make this one-page handout, and you will be using it for years to come. People will be emailing you, who are those doctors again? Who do I refer to? And this is great because you kind of eliminate that whole, oh, well, yeah, I took him to the doctor and the doctor said he's fine. And I'm like, he's not fine. And it's so annoying because obviously I don't know more than the doctor. I'm not a doctor, but I know that there's something going on with this child's vision. And the mom feels like, well, I already took him. So it sets us back a step. So if you can get the names of the doctors who are doing the kind of, definitely make that list for your community. It will be something that you rely on for years to come.
So next we're going to talk about the vision therapy optometrist, or the VTODs is my shorthand for that. So what happens is, for some optometrists, after they complete optometry school, they go and do a fellowship to learn about how to provide intervention for the visual system. While this is the most complete eye exam that you're going to be able to get, for me, sometimes their vision exam may be a little bit extensive, where we're talking about 3-hour exams with visual perception testing and visual motor integration testing and all of these sort of things. When we are aware that this child has a near vision focusing problem, there may be an excessive amount of testing, but the functional vision will be completely assessed and covered. The big problem here is that with vision therapy doctors, they are rarely covered by insurance. Some are figuring out how to get their evaluations covered by insurance, but you should expect for there to be an out-of-pocket fee for a VTOD's assessment. Numbers I've heard for this assessment are as low as $500 and as high as $700 or $800 for an assessment. The other things that you get with vision therapy optometrists is there's a broad range of services they may be offering, right? Some of it's going to look like a lot of things we're going to be doing. They may be assessing retained primitive reflexes. They may be using things like interactive metronome or astronaut protocol or these other sort of tools that we are involved in. They may also be doing some things that maybe are not 100% evidence-based. Things like syntonic, or they've actually changed the name of this now to be optometric phototherapy. It's all the same thing. It's looking at lights, and the science behind this is not the best, but for me, that's not even relevant because the evidence supporting active intervention as the solution, as the best solution for treating convergence insufficiency, did not include syntonics, did not include light therapy. We know that it's not necessary. There are going to be those sort of things happening as well. When it comes time for the intervention, typically, this VTOD is going to tell you, well, you have an 8-year-old and we've diagnosed him with convergence insufficiency and he has binocular dysfunction and accommodative insufficiency and he's hyperopic. And our protocol for an 8-year-old with convergence insufficiency is we're going to see him for 50 visits. Those visits are going to be $200 a piece and we're going to need all of that up front. So they're going
Yikes.
to ask you to stroke a check for 10 grand to do this visit. So for all of these reasons, the other thing with vision therapy doctors is they're communities that don't have a VTOD. Let's talk about the other side of this. Things are changing in vision therapy as this collaborative model with occupational therapy begins to develop and becomes more clear and more defined. So there are vision therapy doctors that are figuring out first how to get these things insurance covered, that are using more evidence-based interventions, that are actually doing assessments, and then they send their information and their suggestions for intervention to an occupational therapist trained to provide that vision intervention. Those things are happening and changing, but be aware that the standard and most likely outcome is your family telling you this eye exam is $700 and they want us to pay $8,000 upfront for his treatment, and we don't have the finances for that. As I said, this isn't everywhere. This isn't all the docs. They're doing a better job of figuring out how to get this done. But for the most part, this is most likely going to be the model that you find. So some of those optometrists that complete vision therapy VTOD training, they want to get additional training. And some optometrists go directly to the Neuro-Optometric Rehab Association and get training to be a neuro-optometric rehab specialist. So these doctors are going to be specializing in the vision problems associated with stroke, TBI, and concussion, things like double vision and dizziness, convergence and saccade problems, field cuts, those sort of things. So some of these docs have worked very hard to get inpatient privileges and are actually part of the interdisciplinary team in inpatient acute units. So this is happening more and more. Know that the other side of this coin is some of the downside for outpatient intervention by a Nora doc is going to be similar with the vision therapy doctors. Many of them are still going to be a cash-based business. They may be expensive. They may be utilizing interventions that are not necessarily 100% evidence-based. The other thing with a Nora doctor is there's less Nora doctors than there are vision therapy doctors. If you're having a hard time finding a vision therapy doctor, you're probably going to have a harder time finding a Nora doctor. So you can go to covd.org and you can find the vision therapy doctors in your area. You can go to noravisionrehab.org and search there to find the Nora doctors in your area. So this goes back to where we started, right? The best exam is the eye exam that's accessible for your patient. It's the eye exam that they can afford. It's the eye exam that gets done. That's important, right? So we at least, all of these doctors are going to get them in the appropriate glasses and ideally have them in best corrected visual acuity. They'll be involved in managing any sort of amblyopia or anything else that's involved with that. So all of those docs will be able to do those things. So I saw a saccade problem, but the doc didn't say anything about a saccade problem. If we get a patient, let's take this a little bit bigger. You have a child who has a weak hand, they're having a hard time holding their pencil. So they go, do you send them to an orthopedist and go, can you assess their hand and see if there's any physical problem with their hand? We would most likely not do that, right? We would take the results of our testing and go, there's definitely weakness. There's definitely decreased range of motion there. And we're going to manage those things, right? So the results of our ocular motor testing, when we're looking at saccades, when we're looking at tracking, and for the most part, when we're looking at near vision focusing deficits, particularly in a child who has the appropriate glasses, we can observe that there is functional problem, and this performance component is not up to an age-appropriate level. So this is certainly something we can address. We don't need the doctor to also agree that, look, there is a tracking problem. More than likely, they didn't look at that. This is whether it's ophthalmology, whether it's optometry. A vision therapy doctor, a neuro doc are much more likely to be assessing those things and be assessing them at a much deeper level. But our typical optometrist, our typical ophthalmologist even, may not be looking specifically at saccades, looking at pursuit assessment, or even looking at things like a cover test in this that we're going to talk about in our assessment protocol. So do you need the doctor to say, yes, there's a saccade problem? Not really. You observed it, you've objectified and measured it, and you know that it's affecting functional problem. That's the big thing we need to know as we talk about this. We're not treating vision problems. We're treating functional problems that have a vision-based root cause.
So here are our key takeaways from this module. The most important thing is that it's all about access. We want our student to have an eye exam. Any eye exam is better than no eye exam. When it comes to the different vision professionals, you're most likely and best off recommending an optometrist. Years ago, I couldn't really remember the difference between an optometrist and an ophthalmologist. I was always getting them confused. So when I would go to talk to the parent and I would be like, and I couldn't remember which one to say to them. So I came up with this little acronym, OPT to recommend. Like that's optimal recommendation, the optometrist. The ophthalmologist has an H and an A in it, and they are most concerned with the health and the acuity of the eye. They're not doing that deeper look at the child's scanning, depth perception, you know, tracking skills. How does it impact functioning? The optometrist, not all of them, but most likely if you want that kind of an exam, it's an optometrist. So opt to recommend the optometrist. In your resources, we've got those great documents I told you about. We have a vision referral checklist that Robert designed that will give you just some kind of decision-making guidance in terms of, does my student need to be referred for, you know, a further vision assessment? We have the eye exam reminder, which should go out to the whole school district in all reality, but definitely to your kids as soon as you receive an occupational therapy evaluation referral. You want to tell the parents to go take the kid for an eye exam or check in to see if they did have an eye exam. And then we have those documents which are helping you to write your referrals, whether it's for a TVI or a COM. We've got sample and example blurbs of how you can document what you want. Of course, you're going to make that reflective of the case that is in front of you, but it's great to just have some examples and some samples that you can pull from to basically back up your request. We also have some pages on key phrases that will protect you, key phrases that you can say and that you can write that will help you with your documentation and with your verbal requests. So be sure to check your resources for all of those great things.